Welcome to the Told Me to Learn and Develop for Medical Educators podcast series from the Frank H. Netter MD School of Medicine. This podcast is for busy medical school faculty who want to expand their knowledge and teaching. I'm your host, Dr. Lisa Coplett, and I will bring you interviews with experts in medical education, fellow faculty, and medical students to discuss the issues most relevant to today's medical educators. Today, we're talking about how we can improve engagement of our learners through our teaching. Joining me today is Dr. JT Torres, the director of the Center for Teaching and Learning, also called the CTL, at Quinnipiac University, and an assistant professor of English. JT has a PhD in educational psychology and uses his expertise to help the CTL to achieve the goals of promoting active learning environments and improving the quality of student learning experiences. JT, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we talk about how we as faculty can increase learner engagement, I would like to explore the meaning of engagement and what that term really means and why it's important in learning. So I know the term has many different facets and defining it very simply can be very challenging. So how do you define learner engagement?
For sure. I love this question because it really disrupts how we've traditionally thought about learning. And by that, I mean, we view it as neck up, right? That all learning, it takes place in the brain or the mind, is all about content and memorizing that content. Engagement really reminds us that we are more than just a brain, right? We have whole bodies, we have emotions, we have experiences, we have imaginations and dreams and aspirations. There's all these complex parts that make us human and that also make us really interesting learners in a situation. And so it really requires us to ask questions about how is what I'm teaching emotionally relevant? How is it socially relevant? How is it personally relevant? And how do we go beyond just viewing learning as knowledge banking and then knowledge demonstration?
So engagement formally has all of those components, right?
Yeah.
And yet you don't have to be engaged with all those parts of yourself to say that you're engaged though, right?
Exactly. Yeah, and that also takes a lot of pressure off of the teacher because as I talk to many, many educators in college level and in the public K through 12 sector, we can really overwhelm ourselves by thinking, how do I engage all of my students, even those who have like 100 to 200 students a semester? You don't have to try to check off that you are engaging everybody through the exact same ways, because that's not only impossible, but will overwhelm us as teachers and educators. But what options and choices can we make for the learner to find the connections that matter to them and choose how they want to be engaged in any particular situation?
Yeah. One of the things that I know that I get muddled in the term engagement is active learning. Mm-hmm. Can you separate those out for me?
Yeah, perfect. That connects really well with what I was just sharing. So active learning is an aspect of engagement, but it tends to really focus on participation, right? So how active, often physically active, are you in a situation? So we get things like case studies, project-based learning, and it really focuses on the embodied experience of somebody doing something in that learning situation. And that's fantastic, that's powerful. We've seen a lot of empirical studies showing that active learning is great for a lot of circumstances, but not all the circumstances. So for instance, there have been questions about active learning and its impact on students who are neurodivergent and students with different abilities who may or may not be able to do all the quote-unquote hands-on things that active learning entails. So engagement just widens the scope a little bit and says, yeah, you can be very engaged in a learning situation without moving out of your chair, perhaps, right? So we tend to look at the behavioral pieces of engagement and say, if I have students who are doing things, who are creating projects, then they're totally engaged. But then that really discounts students who don't have the same mobility and abilities, right, who might be engaged emotionally or socially in those different ways. So engagement just widens the scope. So we can think of active learning as one possible strategy having people actively involved participating. And then we can think of engagement as, well, what does participation look like that isn't so bodily, for example?
I don't know if anybody listening is as interested as I am right now, but I'm super interested in all of this. I feel like I could chat with you for hours about it. So as you're saying that, I'm thinking about, how about this? You give a student a question to answer, and all the students in the class have to answer that question. They don't necessarily have to speak their answer, but to me, then the purpose of that would be that I'm trying to actively engage them cognitively, right? So they're not moving out of their chair, but yet I hope I'm doing something as a teacher to sort of require them to actively learn, I think. So how would you explain that?
Yeah, I think you're describing a little bit universal design for learning, right? Like, how can students opt into the situation in ways that work for them? So I always try to provide as many options as possible for my students. And when you mentioned, you know, you started off by saying, I give students a question, you could also invite students to ask the questions, mm-hmm. right? And maybe one student poses a question that other students then try to create answers for. So let me back up a little bit, if it's okay, and tell you a little bit of a story about myself and how I got into this position. So I grew up with ADHD, and I struggled a lot in the traditional classroom, to the point where when it was time for me to select colleges, I was going to select no college. And just, I didn't want to be part of this education system anymore that I felt was not built for me. It was built for one type of student and not me. When I did go to college, I went to a community college first, and I had faculty who were very invested in active learning. Me with ADHD, I loved the fact that I was in classrooms where I could get up and walk around if I needed to, that I could work with students and stand while they were working, so I didn't have to be tied to a chair, or that I was charting my own path, asking my own questions, and applying the knowledge in ways that made sense to me, and that application did not always have to be my bodily movement around the room, or you know, working on a project together outside of class and inside of class, but I could also find ways to emotionally connect. Because as I became aware of how I learned and what my place was in learning situations, once I realized there were possibilities beyond the traditional mode, I also became aware that I could very easily become distracted because of my ADHD with active learning as well, where I could easily start doing something else that's not connected and not necessarily meaningful to what I was supposed to be learning. But then realizing that I had these choices in these early experiences that I had in community college, where I got to change the assignment if I wanted to. Like, mm-hmm. I had faculty who said, like, if there's an aspect of this that you would change and do differently, go ahead and do it. And I was able to do those things to connect with whatever my interests were at that time. And I realized that I didn't have to just be running around sweating to demonstrate my active participation, but I could find ways to stay focused even as I had these impulses to always run around. So I'm not sure how much that story answers your question necessarily, but basically what I'm trying to get at is I fell in love with learning for the first time as a college student because I was invited to make decisions about how I would learn and when I would learn. And the faculty member just guided those decisions for me, but I still got to choose what was relevant.
I think it's incredibly relevant to the conversation, and I'm thinking specifically about medical educators and about the fact that one of our wonderful challenges that I think we have is that we must help our learners learn to be effectively self-directed, because as you know, it's the amount of information that you need to know to be a physician, particularly now with information explosion, is just massive. So we can never teach them everything that they need to know, but one of the things we have to teach them is how to self-assess what you need, right? Mm-hmm. What gaps you have in any particular moment, or when you're with a patient, what is it about this patient that I need to learn more about, and then go and effectively create the clinical question, go out and find the answer, apply it back to your patient, that whole process. And then of course we want to stimulate scholarship too, right? And so we want them to be thinking about what does interest me and mm-hmm. how do I ask that question and how do I answer that question. So I think it's relevant on a whole bunch of different levels. And so what I was thinking of also when you were talking about that example where, you know, you'd have an assignment yet you could sort of change it, make your, so I was thinking, I think if I have it right, that that's active and engaged learning. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah, and you know, another part of engagement, so engagement, again, it really prioritizes and emphasizes what tends to get left out in active learning, right? Emotional value, for instance, but you're also describing curiosity.
Yeah.
And it isn't always a given that just because I'm physically involved in an activity that I'm generating curiosity.
For sure.
And a curious mindset. What you were just describing, that's also, I think that's the golden goal for us, right? Like, how do we create curious people?
Yeah.
When I often say, and I used to say it a lot when I first started teaching, but I tell my first year writing students that my goal is to work myself out of a job. And by that, I mean, I want you all to learn how to guide your own writing, guide your own learning. In theory, that means that I'm training and teaching you how to not need me anymore,
mm-hmm.
but that's gonna take some time.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's also a myth. So I've kind of tempered me saying that because I know it's not a myth. I really believe in social collective growth, right? I am because we are. I can get better when those in my social circle also get better. So I know we're always going to need one another. Interdependence is a really powerful aspect of engagement. And interdependence just means that I can act independently, but I'm also depending on you acting independently together.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really powerful. But I also want students to empower themselves and know that when they have some curiosity, when they have a question that they want to explore, they can immediately apply the tools and the processes and the methods that I've taught them to pursue that curiosity.
There's plenty of evidence on the benefits of active learning, since we were just talking about that, that it promotes deeper and long-lasting learning. What's the bottom line for the literature on engagement? Or are there too many pieces to engagement to answer that?
No, there are a lot of pieces, but we do have a lot of evidence. So I've typically approached engagement in my own research and reading other studies based on the emotional value, so the science of emotion, right? And emotion is an incredibly powerful thing. It not only does it determine what we're interested in and what we, in our own self-confidence, our own self-efficacy, and what we think we can do, but it also tells us at the bare minimum, or I shouldn't say the bare minimum, but at the foundation, where we direct our attention. Our attention is notoriously limited, right? And we can blame social media, and social media does have negative effects. I'm not letting it off the hook. But we can blame how the pandemic has changed the ways that we think and even our neural circuitry to some degree. Google has done the same, and now with new technology like AI and ChatGPT, like all these things are affecting how we think and behave in society. But what we, and especially our attention spans, which even before all those things have been notoriously bad, but emotion, at its bare minimum, taking an evolutionary psychology perspective, if there were a snake in this studio, your emotional reaction probably would be to freak out a little bit, right? And that's gonna save your life. And what that emotion is doing cognitively is telling you, pay attention to this thing, it might be a threat. But emotion can also work in the positive, as in pay attention to this, it feels really good. Or pay attention to this, this is really fun. And knowing that we have such a limited attention span, the traditional view of education and how we learn has been, I'm going to, again, dump all of this knowledge into your brain, just record it, and when you need it, you'll be able to retrieve it. But that, from study after study, demonstrates that's not how cognition works. And so what emotion does is remind us, right, whatever we're particularly focused on in this moment, whether it's threat or promise, we are going to pay a lot of attention to it at that time, just in time. And so we have study after study to show that just-in-time approaches to learning, as in, if this is the thing that you care about right now, let's focus on that. And then when you care about something else, you'll know how to focus on it when that time comes, has been really promising.
That's so interesting. So let's get to the, I could talk about this theoretical piece of it forever. I want to try to get a little bit more to the practical, too. So our audience includes mostly faculty who are busy clinicians, who are teaching students and residents in the hospital or in their practice. What are my first question, I'll separate the questions. So what are clues that their learners are intellectually, emotionally, socially engaged? How do they know that they are?
Yeah, good question. So again, let's go back to the active learning engagement comparison, because I think some of the clues that we tend to depend on are more of those behavioral things, right? When I see a student raising their hand and verbally participating in class, that must mean they're engaged. Well, yeah, that's one indicator, but I also don't want us to always rely on those same indicators. When I first started teaching, I had a student who was always doodling during class, and I got very concerned that this was an indication of distraction or checking out or not caring. And so one day after class, I just started a small conversation with the student about the class itself. And then just, I tried to make it very informal. I didn't want him to feel like he was being assessed. And student knew everything, was able to hold this conversation. I was very impressed. So then I just straight up asked about the doodling, and his response was, no, it helps me focus and stay in the moment. And so I got that, and I had to realize that those clues are going to be very, very different and going to be very hard to predict. And so some of the things that I look out for in my class and that I can recommend to others is paying attention to a positive emotional state. We can't really see that, and it's not going to look the same for everybody, but we can see how it's playing out in class. So one thing that I do in my class is when I have people working in groups, I hold time for small talk. Other people might see that, again, as a sign of distraction or as a clue that people are active, sure, but not active in the class. Mm-hmm. But small talk is, again, another way that we connect, that we center ourselves, that we position ourselves in an environment, and that we kind of feel out the space to make sure that it's one in which we belong and one in which we can engage. Mm-hmm. So we have to be very open-minded about what those clues can look like. And when we're not certain, checking in with students in an informal conversation to just see, are you picking some of this stuff up? Are you learning this? Can really help us. But again, rather than focusing on the specific clues, just keeping our minds open, because everybody's very different and engages different, and it's going to look very different for everybody.
And asking somebody about it is A-okay too.
Yep, exactly, yeah.
Okay, good. And then because engagement, I think of similar to learning, it's occurring within the learner, right? So we can't make it happen. We can encourage it. We can support it.
Absolutely.
We can contribute to it. So what are some really practical things that we can do as clinical teachers?
Yeah, good. It's all about the environment. So I think if we shift our focus a little bit, like how do I engage this individual? Or if you have 200 students, how do I engage 200 individuals, which could be a very overwhelming thought, mm-hmm. and probably not one that's going to engage the teacher, is to think about the environment. How do I create conditions? And you know, this probably goes back to Skinner and operant conditioning, but how do we create conditions in which engagement is likely to happen, most likely to happen? So in my classes, for instance, the first 10-15 minutes is kind of a topical breakdown of something that's going on in the world that's relevant to students. So I've used AI in ChatGPT, for instance. I teach a first year writing class, and I've used that as a topic to say, you can have this technology do all of your writing for you. Why would you ever have to write? And it's just more of a thought experiment. It's just something open. Or maybe I do something like a wonder walk, where when we're focusing on attention and I teach my students about attention so they learn how to harness it, I send them out on a wonder walk, 8 a.m. class, first 10-15 minutes. I know they're coming in sleepy and drowsy. So I say, let's walk around, find a detail that you think most everybody will overlook, and describe that detail on a whole page. And so it might be a blade of grass. It might be one, students have picked one brick in the architecture and focused on what that brick looks like and feels like and sounds like. They have to use all of their senses. And these are really not so much, you know, quote unquote academic exercises, but they're engagement exercises to just get them thinking, involved in the moment. Or we start off some other days where students bring in their own questions in terms of, what do you want to explore? And I've had students come in with their questions and they say things like, what is the strangest musical genre you listen to? Again, like might not have the strongest content connection, but what I'm doing is I'm trying to, so to speak, prime the students for learning, where they're awake now, their attention is focused, their attention is focused, they're present in the moment, and interested and curious. And so setting a tone for the environment where they know they can participate in these different ways. I also, for the first year writing class, and I apologize for using that as an example, but I'm just trying to...
It's really helpful. I'm actually thinking of clinical examples as you're doing it. So we'll talk about them.
Perfect. I also want the room to feel like an engaging laboratory-like space. So whenever I notice that chatter is breaking out, and even if that chatter is a little bit off topic, I will go and I will engage in that conversation. So for instance, if I have students, registration week just happened, and they're talking about what classes they should take, I will walk over there. Instead of shutting down the conversation, I'll ask them, what drives your decision to take a particular class? And then I'll work into it, and then I'll just try to swing it back to what we were talking about, because I don't want to shut down the chatter, because I know that's usually a good indicator that people are awake, present, and enjoying the experience. And enjoyment, by the way, is really important. We shouldn't separate that from learning. And I had, in my first year writing class, I usually invite a librarian to come over and talk about research. How do we use the QU library? And one time they came in, and the students were pretty boisterous about like sharing their research topics, sharing their questions. And the librarian said, this is a very lively class. And one of the students said, it's JT's fault. He makes us this way. And I was like, yeah, that is the most beautiful thing I've ever heard from a student. And so the environment, right? Like, we can't create a very serious, rigid environment and then expect engagement. People will fit into their ecosystem. Yeah. Young students are very savvy at doing that, right? I mean, they're social creatures, and the adolescent brain is very attuned to social environments because of the need to feel connected into communities. Yeah. And so they're very good at reading a room and figuring out how they fit in. And so the room itself, not just the physical room, but the spatial room itself, needs to promote engagement in those ways.
There are so many examples that you gave that made me think about how could you translate that? Let's say you're teaching in it's your practice, it's just you and one student, right? That's one example of, you know, where somebody might be teaching and I was imagining that when you were talking about the Wonder Walk. Mm-hmm. And, you know, learning how to observe. Mm-hmm. Is a really important skill for everybody. It's particularly important in medicine because one of the things you always learn is, you know, you should be observing from the moment you walk into the room with the patient because you'll learn so much from like a deep observation. And so I could imagine doing something like that with a student, right? And it doesn't have to be with a patient, though. It could be with anything, you know.
Exactly.
You know, pick something in this room and, you know, write about it for 5 minutes and what you saw.
And really quickly on,
yeah.
It's really fun to watch them surprised when they do that kind of observation activity. I use the Wonder Walk as an introduction into analysis when I'm teaching them how to analyze, how to critically think. I say exactly what you just said. We go from observation to interpretation, right? Typically, how our brains work. So the better you are at observation, the more creative your analysis is going to be just by observing what no one else observes. And it's fun watching their surprise. I've had them do it competitively in a room, see if you can notice a detail that no one else sees, and they all blow each other's minds when they like describe something so specific in the room that everyone's like, we've been in this room all semester and I've never seen that crack in the wall in that one location.
Oh, right, that's amazing.
Or I've done this in a capstone course. So these are seniors, and they've said, I've come to this university for 4 years and I never noticed this thing that I just spent 20 minutes describing now in my journal.
Yeah. And then the other thing that I was thinking about was emotion. So, for example, one of the things, you know, that I've learned about is if you're not necessarily teaching with a patient, that builds in its own active, emotional, social, there's so many like elements of that when the patients are, but if a patient's not there and you're giving a talk on renal failure, you know, whatever it might be, that one of the ways to help engage is to start out with a case, like a real case of somebody who you saw, and that if it's dramatic, all the better, right? Because you're sort of, you're grabbing them and you're pulling them in and getting them interested and like you said, sort of priming their brains for learning, right? And I was also thinking about when you are with a patient and you are there, I mean, there's a lot of emotion in medicine that you experience, and you have, you're in an emotional setting, is there a way as a teacher to sort of leverage either unidentified emotions that might be happening, or if you see that there's something emotionally happening with a learner, sort of how could you appropriately maybe sort of utilize that to enhance their learning?
Yeah, good questions. There's a growing field. It's not a new field, but a growing field in social emotional learning. And there's some questions around social emotional learning. The whole idea behind social emotional learning is another aspect of engagement, right? A way for us to try to language what does it look like to be socially and emotionally involved, and how do we find those indicators, and how do we know what's going on. One of the pitfalls of social emotional learning, I don't want to take us too far on a tangent, is that it tends to turn into emotional regulation. Like, we put the burden on the student to say, you might be feeling this, figure it out on your own. And we don't want to do that either, right? We want we want emotion to be a place where we center our experiences. But we also want to teach students how to reflect on, not necessarily regulate, but reflect on and be able to articulate, I'm feeling this thing right now, and I don't know if it's okay, right? And you just have students practice verbalizing that, knowing how they can find support, safety. But it first starts with that articulation of it. So reflections, and frequent reflections for students to articulate, like, this is what I'm thinking, but this is also what I'm feeling, in a way that can create dialogue with their support systems, whether or not that includes the instructor. It might include their cohort, a dyad that they're working in, or triad, whatever. But ways for them to share out and primarily share with themselves. So they know that, yeah, I am validating this experience that I'm having right now. I need to pause, or I need to take a step back, and I need to think this through, or they could be very positive emotions, like, yeah, I'm confident, and like, this is building my self-efficacy, and I feel that I can keep moving forward with this patient, or with this this diagnosis makes a lot of sense to me, right? And my emotions are aligned with my knowledge. So it can go in a variety of ways, but teaching students how to reflect on that, because that's a really important professional skill as well for team building, for communication. And then it provides the assessment data that the instructor would need to know, here's what's going on in the room.
Yeah. I mean, I've been lucky enough to be a narrative medicine facilitator in the School of Medicine for a long time, and yet I hadn't thought about that if you're teaching clinically, you could even simply ask your students, you know, if they want to, you know, spend 10 minutes writing and reflecting after an emotional experience with a patient, and then talk about it and ask them if they want to talk about what they wrote.
Exactly.
And I hadn't thought about that.
Or keeping memos, or just keeping some ways. And I think this also pushes back against some of the problematic energies we have in our society. And by that, I mean, we're a very fast-paced society, which means we tend to jump from task to task to task. We don't always pause to think about what that task meant to us, and how completing one task is going to inform the way we approach the next task. So this is not just for emotional validation, but also for our own learning, to have those moments which go against everything that we do in our incredibly fast-paced world.
Yeah, it sure does.
To just say, like, let's breathe together, and let's think about what just happened, and let's be mindful about what just happened.
I saw this quote once that's always stuck in my head, and I want to say it's by somebody named Arsenault, and it says, 10 years of experience without reflection is just 1 year's experience repeated 10 times.
I love that.
Yeah. So now one of the things I'm going to take away from today is reflection. That's a really great way, a practical way, to also increase engagement with our learners.
Exactly. And I love to also share the John Dewey quote that education equals experience plus reflection. Mm-hmm. I always share that with my students. Because everybody has heard the phrase, like, that you need to travel because that makes you a well-rounded person. Traveling's good for you. And then I share, when I was an undergraduate, I traveled to Cancun for spring break, and I didn't learn anything except where Senor Frogs was, right? Like, so, I mean, you can't just go and have an experience and expect that to result in any meaningful knowledge. There has to be intentional reflection involved in it as well.
That's a great way to end, JT. I love that example. JT, thank you for an incredibly interesting discussion. Every time we talk, I feel like the boundaries of my thinking have been expanded. Thank you for taking the time to talk today and for sharing your expertise.
Thank you so much. This is amazing. Totally grateful to be here. And you also expand my horizons as well.
Well, thank you. I'm Lisa Coplett. Thanks for listening. I would like to thank the people who contributed to this show: Katie Lyons, our fabulous producer; Grace McGuire, our assistant producer; David DeRoche, our program director. For more information on other faculty development opportunities at Netter, email katie.lyons@qu.edu. For more information on all of Quinnipiac's podcasts, visit qu.edu/podcast. Also follow us on Twitter and Instagram @QU Podcasts.